Good evening. Next up, we have some very special programming. An independent historian done a deep dive into the strangest story ever told from his podcast, Wrangle History Unlocked. Hope you enjoy. Stay tuned with us.
It's really nice being around the campfire with you two.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to tell some scary stories?
No.
I do.
Why do not?
Are they too scary for you, Conan?
A little.
But you like them, right, Rosemary?
Yes, I do.
What do you like about them?
Everything.
What if we tell a story about Bigfoot?
I'd love to.
No, but you're already Bigfoot.
Do I look like Bigfoot?
Yeah, because you're big.
This is going to be so funny.
What does a Bigfoot smell like?
Rotten fish.
Rotten fish.
And cat pee.
And cat pee?
And a dead bird.
That does sound kind of scary.
I would be literally terrified.
Okay, I'm going to tell you a story I heard when I was a little boy. If it gets too scary, don't worry. You're going to be all right. I promise. Today, on Wrangle History Unlocked, we're going inside the strangest story ever sold. Look out for Bigfoot, Kushtaka, an alien, and a place that's like Wrangle, only different. Petersburg. Chapter 1, A Voice from the Grave. In June 1950, Petersburg, Alaska, turned out to mourn one of its own. Harry Douglas Kolb was an authentic Alaskan sourdough. Over half a century, Harry worked almost every kind of job there was in Petersburg. When Harry died at the age of 68, he left behind a wife, three grown children, and many friends. The Petersburg Press ran this obituary.
Mr. Kolb was born at Montevideo, Minnesota, and his boyhood was spent in Tacoma. In 1898, he came to Wrangle, remaining there until 1902, carrying mail to Cake, working in the sawmill, and prospecting. When he left Wrangle in 1902, it was to come to Petersburg, and since that time, this has always been his home.
Harry Kolb was buried in Petersburg Memorial Cemetery under a headstone with the epitaph, "Here he rests in the country he loved." With Harry's remains resting peacefully in the ground, his widow, 63-year-old Minnie Kolb, began the work of sorting through his personal effects. It was a labor of love mixed with grief, the final act of saying goodbye. But Minnie found something unexpected.
Many years have passed since the beginning of this mystery was first brought to my attention. Yet, in all this time, it still remains a mystery.
Tucked away in a box, Minnie found stacks of pages.
A something that those who have been involved the most are still unable to figure out to their satisfaction. If you, who read this, can solve the riddle in a sane, reasonable way, you will be doing me and the other men interested a great favor.
Each page was scrawled with her late husband's handwriting.
I, H.D. Kolb, being no writer, yet feeling that this story should be told, am setting the facts down as best I can to one of the strangest experiences that ever was brought to my notice.
Minnie heard Harry's voice in the pages of his story. The spring of 1900 found four men batching together in a shack at Wrangell, Alaska. All four were broke, as is usual with prospectors. As luck would have it, I was one of the four. The story took place inside Thomas Bay, at the foot of the mighty, majestic mountain peak, Devil's Thumb. But Harry had another name for the area.
I knocked around different parts of Alaska, but I always had in mind to make one more trip to the Devil's Country.
In Harry's story, eerie, inexplicable things happen in Devil's Country. There's an abandoned campsite with no one to be found. Dog tracks in the snow followed by footprints of a larger, mysterious creature. Harry described first-hand accounts of people visiting Devil's Country who become paranoid and delusional. The most disturbing events in Harry's story come from his mining companion, Charlie.
Fellows, I have been on the trail of an old buck Indian for the last month, trying to get him to tell me where he picked up a piece of free gold quartz he has at his camp. I never said anything about it before, because I wanted to get the story from him first. And today, he spilled the beans. He told me to go up to Thomas Bay.
Charlie leaves Harry and the others in Wrangell and spends days hiking above Thomas Bay until he finds a massive ledge of gold-speckled quartz. Charlie uses the butt of his rifle to chip off a large piece of it, but in doing so, he breaks his rifle, leaving him defenseless. After a bit more hiking, Charlie succeeds in finding the Half Moon Lake, but out of nowhere, Charlie is attacked.
Swarming up the ridge toward me from the lake were the most hideous creatures. I couldn't call them anything but devils, as they were neither men nor monkeys, yet looked like both. They were entirely sexless, their bodies covered with long, coarse hair, except where the scabs and running sores had replaced it. Each one seemed to be reaching out for me and striving to be the first to get me. The air was full of their cries, and the stench from their sores and bodies made me faint. I forgot my broken gun and tried to use it on the first ones when I threw it at them and turned and ran. God, how I did run. I could feel their hot breath on my back. Their long, claw-like fingers scraped my back. The smell from their steaming, stinking bodies was making me sick, while the noises they made, yelling, screaming, and breathing, drove me mad. Reason left me. How I reached the canoe or how I hung on to that piece of quartz, I do not know.
At the end of his story, Charlie swears to his fellow companions.
You, no doubt, think I'm either crazy or lying. All I can say is, there is the quartz. Never let me hear the name of Thomas Bay again. And for God's sake, help me get away tomorrow on that boat.
Fred and John are the next to go. They are only gone 3 weeks. John reports that Fred went crazy, at one point getting on all fours and barking like a dog. Before Fred leaves Alaska forever, he tells Harry,
I believe the gold is there, as Charlie said. I also believe that he didn't lie about what he saw, because I had one of those devils sitting on the bow of the canoe from Thomas Bay to Horn Cliffs, and he cursed me for stopping every time I tried to rest from paddling.
With Harry long gone, Minnie could only speculate on the truth of the story. But one member of the Culp family took an interest. Virginia Culp was just 22 years old when her father died. Her oldest brother, Douglas, lived in Fairbanks with his own family. Her next oldest brother, Richard, lived in Petersburg and ran a store. Virginia, who worked in a shrimp cannery, sensed a business opportunity. In 1953, Virginia Culp published her father's story through Exposition Press out of New York City. While the working title was called Devil's Country, the book was published under a name that would become legendary in the halls of Alaskan folklore. The Strangest Story Ever Told. The book's jacket advertises,
"What were these nightmarish figures? Were they supernatural beings, or visitors from another world, or survivors from some prehistoric era? Whatever they were vicious, soul-tormenting, body-destroying, and evil."
As Virginia wrote in the book's preface,
"It was, then, a very pleasant surprise when Mother found the manuscript just a short time ago and gave it to me to read. I found it fascinating, and I was left with a feeling of curiosity. I wonder if any of you readers will be curious. I wonder. I'll just let you wonder.
Chapter 2. A Legend is Born. Though slim and concise, The Strangest Story Ever Told has gone on to become a fixture of Alaskan literature. For many families, it is a story passed down through generations, from adults to children and grandchildren. When the book was first published in 1953, it sold for $2. Over the years, the book has been reprinted multiple times. After Alaskan statehood in 1959, Alaska Marine Highway ferries crisscrossed southeast Alaska, often carrying a copy of the book in the gift shop, ensuring it reached the hands of locals and tourists. The book has taken on a life of its own, and so have the devils. From the start, the little devils in the story captured the spotlight. When the book came out, an anonymous reader of the Anchorage Daily News promised to investigate personally the story of hideous creatures. The book spawned a new category of wilderness explorer, devil hunters. Here's an example from the March 22, 1957, Petersburg Press.
"Two men, Clarence Livingston and Jay Rust, both from Washington, were in the country last year, according to Virginia Culp. They reported finding the lake shaped like a quarter moon and one shaped like the letter S, but found no gold or devils or strangeness. They plan to return to the area again this summer."
In 1960, the Petersburg Chamber of Commerce was forced to weigh in when it became known that a local hunter was actively searching for the devils described in the book. The Petersburg Press reported,
"Some wished to outlaw such hunting if done with a bow and arrow, and others wanted to send the movie rights to Warner Brothers Studios if they would film the adventure in the area next summer."
The April 1st, 1966, New Petersburg Press wrote,
"Big discovery points to hairy men. Skeptics who, after reading Virginia Culp's father's book, The Strangest Story Ever Told, have smiled and shaken their heads, may have another shake coming. A Canadian engineer reported finding three distinct tracks similar to, but larger than, those of humans. Also found was what appeared to be a primitive campsite or living area with the remains of a partially devoured wolf that had a crude stone axe embedded in its skull."
Around 1971, the U.S. Forest Service published a guide for interpreters aboard Alaska Marine Highway ferries, which had this to say about Thomas Bay.
"So far as is known, that gold is still up there, and so are the devil men. If you're game enough to take the trip up there sometime, maybe someone from Wrangell would like to go along. They say the scenery down below the Devil's Thumb is out of this world."
In May 1978, the Petersburg Pilot reported a team of 22 individuals would travel to Thomas Bay to investigate strange occurrences. The paper wrote,
"Steve Adderton, 24, of Gig Harbor, Washington, has organized a 22-man party made up of chemists, anthropologists, zoologists, biologists, and cooks, to name a few, that will travel to the shores of Thomas Bay to investigate reports of 2.5-foot dwarves and hairy creatures that are said to exist in the area. 76 persons responded to the advertisement, from which Mr. Atherton selected 22 people to make the trip with him this summer.
None of these expeditions ever found any devils. But for some, there is no mystery. Based on clues from the book, they believe they know the creature Harry Culp is describing. And it's no devil. Chapter 3, Tales from the Cryptids. One group points to the strangest story ever told as further proof of a creature they believe is more than myth. Bigfoot. Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, however you call it, is a creature known around the world. Many Native American cultures have stories and names for Bigfoot. Bigfoot sightings are rare, but when they do happen, it tends to be in places where human beings have penetrated deeply into the wilderness. According to the January 14, 1978 Anchorage Daily News,
the subject of Sasquatch surfaced again in the late 1960s when an individual contacted authorities about trying to trap a Bigfoot in the Thomas Bay region of southeast Alaska. Colonel Frederick W. Wolstad, Protection Division Director, said although Bigfoot is not a legal species at this point, the beast is still protected by state law because nobody can hunt or kill an animal for which no season or bag limit has been established.
The internet has allowed Bigfoot enthusiasts to network and share ideas like never before. In an e-book entitled Sasquatch Behavior, author Bobby Short wrote,
"The Culp story is more an account of Sasquatch attack rather than a chase story. For me, the realism of it came when I read his words, 'Stench from their sores and bodies made me faint.' That brought it home."
In August 2024, the Historical Sasquatch Society shared on Facebook,
"The account tells of four men, Harry Culp and John, Fred, and Charlie, ventured into Thomas Bay in the spring of 1900. Charlie encountered a troop of smelly Sasquatch while on a ridge overlooking a mountain lake."
To help us understand Bigfoot better, here's a lover of big, smelly creatures, my wife, Mary Rudy.
Bigfoot is big and strong. I wouldn't want to mess with Bigfoot. In fact, I would just probably stay away from Bigfoot. I think I really first thought about Bigfoot watching the movie Harry and the Hendersons. And it's about a Bigfoot who is hit by a car. They ended up taking him in and having him live in their basement. And so you fall in love with this lovable large Bigfoot.
So no plans to have a Bigfoot live in your basement?
I already live with a five-year-old. I'm pretty good on that front.
We recently took our kids to the North American Bigfoot Center.
There's a butt print on display, which I think was really compelling. And there are a lot of footprint casts that have been taken from all over the country.
What does Bigfoot smell like?
Garbage or a really, really wet dog.
How do Bigfoot reproduce?
Is that appropriate for this podcast?
Good night, everybody. Bigfoot believers aren't alone in attempting to find an explanation for what Harry Culp described. Another group looks no further than Southeast Alaska's own Tlingit culture to a spirit world being known to transcend boundaries of land and water, Kushtaka. According to the legend, Kushtaka are land otters who can change form to appear as someone you know. Having gained your trust, Kushtaka may attempt to lure you to go with them. If they lure you into the water, it may be to your death. Just as Harry Culp described monkey-like creatures, so too did the Reverend Harry Corser describe Kushtaka as monkeys in his book, Totem Lore of the Alaska Indians.
The Kushtaka are the boogeymen of the Tlingit people.
Their existence was firmly believed in. Some of the more educated of the Indians, who are familiar with the different Kushtaka legends, explain them by supposing that at one time, monkeys lived in Alaska.
In January 1975, Roger Painter wrote in the Southeastern Log,
"As persistent as the gold rumors are, tales that the gold is protected by hordes of Kushtakas, half-man, half-otter creatures of Tlingit Indian legend. Many a prospector looking for the Thomas Bay motherlode is said to have returned scared out of his wits, babbling tales of the hideous devil creatures that chased him out of the bay empty-handed."
In May 1994, the Petersburg Pilot argued that the strangest story ever told is about Kushtaka.
"Each of the men, alone in the woods during the encounter, came back silent or temporarily senseless, so shaken that most either never wanted to step foot in the area or even the state again. What happened to them in the meantime often remained vague, except that they faced or were chased by the land otter people."
After visiting Thomas Bay in June 2020, Morgan Trimble wrote about her experiences for Getaway.com.
"Some speculate that the Thomas Bay monsters are neither ghosts nor devils. They're Kushtaka, the mythical half-man, half-otters from Tlingit folklore. Kushtaka mimic cries of women in distress to lure their victims, whom they invariably rip to shreds or turn into fellow Kushtaka."
Even the U.S. Forest Service has taken on the legend. In an official guide for Thomas Bay, the Forest Service wrote,
"There are also tales of tragedy about the bay, a report of a slide that destroyed a village killing over 500 people, and the hauntings of Kushtakas in the S Lake area."
In 2013, actor Charlie Sheen chartered a private plane to Sitka, Alaska, to investigate Kushtaka. He described Kushtaka to TMZ.
"A shape-shifting trickster who is half-man, half-otter. It lures one away from the campsite with the mimicked sounds of a crying baby, then kills you, takes on your form, and returns to the scene for more suckers or prey. It obviously knew our group was far too skilled to be snowed in this fashion, so it stayed hidden like a sissy."
To help us better understand Kushtaka, here's my friend, John Schenck. Or is it really him?
From my experience, I've heard people talking where Kushtakas have red glowing eyes and that they shapeshift into people that you know, but then some other people will say, no, they just shapeshift into objects that are just common throughout Southeast because that's all they know.
With the Kushtaka, there's a level of respect there where native and non-native people keep an attitude of like, I'm not going to mess with that. I'm not going to make fun of it. I'm not going to celebrate it. And I think that says something about us. I don't know exactly what it is.
You know, people will dress up during Halloween as a Sasquatch and still big deal. You don't get people dressing up like a Kushtaka. You don't get people having like Kushtaka Fest because the Kushtakas overall, the belief is just they're a little bit, they're more evil. They have like a more evil tendency. They're scary. They're just a scarier mythological creature that you don't want to encounter out in the woods. I don't know if you've ever told your kids certain ghost stories, but sometimes, you know, parents will tell their children these scary stories just to teach them a lesson, right? There's lessons to be learned from fear because fear is such a huge emotion. It works really well in a place like Southeast Alaska as well because Southeast has a lot more obstacles. Just when you look at the geography of the trees, the mountains, the lakes and the ponds and everything, the rocks, the coastline, everything. It's very jagged. There's a lot of shapes that are going on. There is so much that could be hiding behind trees, be hiding behind rocks. You don't know what's going to be in front of you after you walk 10 steps. You know, it's just, oh, there's more trees, but you still, there's always going to be that mystery element where you get disoriented very quickly. I mean, there's a reason why people get lost. Yeah. So that's what I mean. That Southeast is a treacherous area of the world, and it shouldn't be taken lightly.
In more recent times, a new theory has emerged that is not so supernatural, but just as unbelievable. Some people think the hairy little devils Harry Culp described may have been Chinese survivors of a shipwreck. It's a theory that has shown up online, like on Tara Nielsen's blog, Alaska for Real. She describes hearing the theory from a longtime Alaskan.
My father found out there'd been a shipwreck not that long before the prospector was on the scene. No lives were saved, supposedly. But what if some of the passengers, which were mostly Chinese immigrants brand new to the country and not speaking a word of English, made it ashore? They could have lived in the caves and subsisted on mountain goats, using the hides for clothes when theirs gave out.
Thankfully, we don't have to wonder anymore. Like Harry wrote in his introduction, if we can solve this riddle in a sane, reasonable way, we'd be doing him a favor. So today, we're going to solve the mystery of the strangest story ever told. And it starts with Harry Culp. Chapter 4, Back to the Source. The biggest mystery about the strangest story ever told may be Harry Culp himself. Harry Culp's obituary and many written profiles after his death say he was born in Minnesota. But Harry Culp was not born in the United States. Harry Culp was an alien. Harry Culp was born in Nova Scotia, Canada, around 1882. He was part of a large family, which migrated to the United States in 1886. Harry's father applied for citizenship, making Harry a citizen as well. But Harry may not have known that. In 1913, Harry applied for U.S. citizenship, but abandoned the application. In the final decades of his life, and in his obituary, Harry Culp's birthplace was recorded as the United States. But this was a myth. Just like Devil's Thumb, Harry Culp presented an American front, but he had a Canadian background. Another mystery about Harry is whether he actually spent time in Wrangell at all. At the beginning of his story, Harry tells us it's the spring of 1900, and he's one of four men batching together in a shack in Wrangell, Alaska. In fact, according to the 1900 census, Harry Culp was 17 years old, a student, and living with his parents in Allen, Washington. It's possible that Harry Culp at least visited Wrangell, but the only Culp who left behind any record of his time in Wrangell was Harry's older brother, Wallace. In the spring of 1898, at the age of 25, Wallace Culp went to Wrangell. His adventures in and around the town generated mentions in the town's local paper, the Stickeen River Journal. Years after Harry's death, the Petersburg Press asked Minnie about those years, and all she could do was laugh and say, "That all happened before we were married." Harry and Minnie were married in 1912 in Tacoma, Washington, where Harry had made his home for several years. Harry and Minnie moved to Petersburg, Alaska, after their marriage, in time to have their first son, Douglas Culp, in October 1914. Their second son, Richard, followed 2 years later in 1916. According to the original typeset manuscript, Harry Culp wrote his story in 1925. At the beginning of that year, the Petersburg Herald wrote about black smoke rolling up the crest of Devil's Thumb.
The vicinity around Devil's Thumb, though not over 40 miles from Petersburg, is practically unexplored. Indians' legends and superstitions and fearful tales from prospectors surround the mysterious land, and besides Thunder Mountain, which trembles from the concussions of the mighty ice fields, there are said to be poisonous fumes and springs which have caused people to become locoed.
At some point in 1925, Harry Culp began writing his story. That year, the Culp family lived on a fox farm outside of Petersburg. They were isolated, as it was too far away for the Culp boys, Douglas, 11, and Richard, 9, to to be able to attend the school in Petersburg. The Culp family relied on each other. For entertainment, they had stories from books and memory. He didn't have a name for it at first, but page by page, Harry scrawled out his incredible, supernatural tale of adventures around Thomas Bay. He poured his years of experience mining around Thomas Bay into the story. He used his mastery of the countryside to make his storytelling better. The story was creepy, spooky, eerie, and unsettling. But it was not gory, and nobody got killed. For a father like Harry Culp, it was the kind of story he might tell kids around a campfire. In fact, it was a story that had been told around campfires. For Harry Culp's story was an incarnation of a much older, familiar folktale, The Lost Rocker. Here's one of the earliest versions of The Lost Rocker from the Juneau Mining Record, republished in the July 22, 1894, Indianapolis Journal.
It was the spring of 1876. Two miners left Sitka on a prospecting expedition, taking a course to the southeast with the intention of exploring the islands along their route, but more especially, to reach the mainland and make extensive search for placer diggings. They crossed Chatham Straits to the mainland and pitched camp at the mouth of a large creek. It was strewn with quartz, and on panning the gravel, color was found. They ascended the stream, and after 2 days traveling over the boulders and winding through underbrush, they reached the headwaters of the creek on the divide. Beyond and below, a short distance in the basin, lay a beautiful little lake. In the little stream putting into the lake, they again found gold. Prospecting and panning the gravel, joy filled their breasts, for they had found a bonanza. The gravel yielded coarse gold the size of beans, and a dollar or more to the pan. One returned to the beach after they cached supplies, while the other partner set to work building a rocker. For a matter of 2 weeks, they washed the gold sands and made occasional trips over to their cache on the beach with no thought whatever of approaching danger and no intimation of the horrible tragedy that was about to occur. On the eventful day at about noon, as they were leaving work to prepare dinner, ambushed savages who had tracked the two lone miners from the beach into the mountains to murder and to plunder poured their fire from behind trees upon them. One was killed outright, but miraculously, the other was untouched. Seeing his companion fall and taking the situation at a glance, he bounded into the timber. Fear lent wings to the pursued, and he soon outdistanced his pursuers, who were unable to get in an effective shot while both were dodging through the timber and underbrush. The pursued made direct for the cache and boat on the beach, and hastily loading up with the remainder of the provisions and effects, he pulled out into the channel. He saw the Indians no more, and shaped his course, as he supposed, for Sitka.
The Lost Rocker was a hit. It appeared in newspapers around the country under headlines like A Bonanza Gold Story from the Wilds of the Far North and Romantic Gold Story from Alaska's Shores. The telling of the story evolved, but in every version of The Lost Rocker, angry Indians surprise and chase the unsuspecting miner out of the woods within an inch of his life. The December 2nd, 1896 Douglas Miner.
When one morning shortly after the beginning of their day's toll, they were fired upon by a party of Indians in ambush, and one of the men fell, probably instantly killed, the other being unharmed. This man reached the woods and eventually the boat.
Just 3 years before Harry Culp wrote his story, the lost rocker appeared in the Cordova Daily Times.
Returning to camp one day, this man had found his two companions murdered, seemingly by Indians. He had taken the treasure and fled over the mountains, crossing three ranges, and had come out at tidewater at a small Indian village or settlement. During the night, he had stolen a canoe and had managed to make his escape and drift about until picked up.
The November 3, 1946 Seattle Daily Times tied together the lost rocker with the mysterious stories about Thomas Bay.
Old prospectors around Wrangell and Petersburg say that the lost rocker is a strike of such richness that the gold literally may be rolled from the ground. Legend relates that the gold is guarded by a lost tribe of Indians who roll huge boulders from the ridges upon all who dare enter the forbidding land to see it.
People have always been skeptical of the lost rocker story. In 1900, the Alaska Dispatch explained what everyone knew at the time.
Alaska is not the only country with the story of a lost rocker to spur on the prospector. Nearly every prospector and mining man in Alaska has from time to time heard more or less the lost rocker, though most frequently in a jesting manner, and many that mention it have but a vague idea of the original story.
Part of mining culture is legends about lost fortunes, like the lost El Dorado, the treasure of Montezuma, the lost cabin, and others. For each legend, the fruitless search becomes part of the story. Eminent Alaska historian Robert D'Armand described the lost rocker like this.
Any mining region, and especially any old mining region, that is deserving of the name should have a legend of at least one lost mine, and in this respect, southeastern Alaska fully qualifies with the legend of the lost rocker. It is a legend that appears to meet all the requirements. General overall vagueness as to both time and place, contradictory details in the many tellings of the story, both verbally and in print, and, above all, the complete unfindability of the lost gold deposit.
When the strangest story ever told came out, it was understood that these stories were already familiar in the culture. It wasn't new. The book's jacket advertised, "The stories have been told over and over around sourdough's campfires and have become part of the legend of the gold country." The Daily Sitka Sentinel described the stories as already a legend among the prospectors, fishermen, and adventure-loving folk of the gold country. Virginia Culp herself commented,
"During the years, the Devil's Country story has been passed along by word of mouth so often that the details had become obscured."
The story of the lost rocker found a lasting home in Thomas Bay, but it evolved to replace angry Indians with supernatural beings. In 1932, the Seward Daily Gateway commented on the local lore of Thomas Bay.
"The area known as Devil's Land, back of Thomas Bay, is not haunted by urchins and queer people. Neither are there great quantities of gold in and near Half Moon Lake, according to an investigation conducted by four men."
The name Devil's Thumb helped lend credence to the idea that evil spirits lived in Thomas Bay. But the name Devil's Thumb had nothing to do with the devil, demons, or any dark spirits. It came from 1869, when the United States Navy sent the USS Saginaw to explore and document Alaska. As Commander Richard Meade passed among the channels of southeast Alaska, he spied a great mountainous peak to the east. It resembled a peak he'd seen before. Meade named the peak Devil's Thumb after a rock off the western coast of Greenland, also called Devil's Thumb. Both rock formations are tall, narrow, rounded on the top, and serve as helpful markers for mariners. The USS Saginaw would sail on, but leave behind the name Devil's Thumb. While the Saginaw's mission was scientific in nature, it was responsible for the shelling and destruction of the Tlingit village of Cake. The only devils Richard Meade saw in Alaska were likely on his own ship. By 1925, the battle for Alaska Native civil rights was in full swing. Petersburg was home to the Alaskan Fisherman newspaper, published by Lewis Paul, whose brother William Paul was the first Tlingit lawyer and served in the Alaska Territorial Legislature. Many Tlingit people attended churches, operated businesses, and were part of everyday life. The Lost Rockers trope about a band of hostile Indians roaming the woods simply did not fit anymore in 1925 when Harry Culp wrote his story. By making the villains of his story little devils instead of Indians, Harry Culp sidestepped sensitive cultural issues and allowed for a freer, more imaginative world. But the parallels are the same. In both The Lost Rocker and Strangest Story Ever Told, it's understood that the gold miner has stepped out of his world into theirs. They live here, he doesn't. And he must confront that he is a trespasser, caught in the act of taking what is not his. And he must face a hasty exile. But there is one piece of the Thomas Bay story that is true. To understand it, we have to go back to the beginning of time, when the world was covered in water. Chapter 5, Generations. In Tlingit oral tradition, it's called the Great Flood. It is similar, in some ways, to the story of Noah's Ark in the Old Testament. Where Noah had a boat, the Tlingit hung to the highest mountain peaks until the water receded. According to William Paul in the Alaska Tlingit,
the legend is that at the time of the Great Flood, people who could reach the top of this mountain with their dogs, the grizzly bear, and mountain goats, were saved. Tlingit's story is told by different tribes situated in different districts in southeastern Alaska would say, that is the mountain that saved my ancestors.
One peak in particular became known as Tal Kunukh Usha, the mountain that saved mankind. It is often simply known as Tal. The Tlingit called the people who lived behind the mountain the Tal Tan. When the flood receded, the people who survived atop the mountains moved down to the coast. Some wound up inside a wide, open-mouthed bay they called Tal Ku. The bay was conveniently located near rivers, glaciers, and the mouth of the Stikine River. This was the home of the Tal Kwedi. It later became known as Thomas Bay in 1887 after U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Thomas. There is evidence of a long history of Tlingit occupation in this area. In 1930, prospectors discovered mummified remains of an 18-month-old girl in a cave in Thomas Bay. Her remains were wrapped in furs and estimated to be 1,000 years old. For generations, the Tal Kwedi lived inside the bay. But then, a devastating landslide changed everything. In the Alaska Tlingit, William Paul described meeting an elderly woman from Haines who described how her clan came to be.
They were the people of Tal. Several generations ago, their ancestors had a village in Thomas Bay, in the shadow of the great mountain Tal. After a terrible slide destroyed the village and many people, some of those who escaped took refuge on the west shore of Duncan Canal.
Some Tal Kwedi headed south after the landslide, joining the village of Katsitlan on the southwest corner of Wrangell Island. Eventually, they all moved north to the harbor where Wrangell is today. The point in front of the town is still named for the Tal Kwedi leader who settled along the peninsula, Shoestack. The landslide imbues Thomas Bay with a sense of tragedy and danger. In his handwritten manuscript, Harry Culp mentioned the landslide near the very end of his story, but in the book version, it was brought onto page 1, in the book's only footnote.
Thomas Bay is known by the natives in Alaska as the Bay of Death. About 150 or 200 years ago, a slide down one of the mountains wiped out a village, killing over 500 of the inhabitants.
The name Devil's Thumb, combined with the tragedy of the landslide, created an otherworldly quality to Thomas Bay as a place where dark spirits mingled with the landscape. In 2009, a writer for the New York Times read the strangest story ever told and remarked that unquiet ghosts had seemingly haunted the place. The most magical thing about the strangest story ever told is that it brought Harry Culp back to life. When asked if her father really believed there were devils at Thomas Bay, Virginia Culp replied,
"No, he didn't really believe it. He thought the devils were a big joke. I think so too, but it makes a good story. Some people take it seriously or call my father a liar, but that doesn't bother me."
When Virginia learned about the 22 people in Seattle ready to explore Thomas Bay, Virginia flatly shot down the idea. The December 13, 1978 Petersburg Pilot wrote,
"Thomas Bay expedition termed foolish. A damper was put on the proposed trip when Virginia Culp, daughter of the author of the book that was the catalyst for the expedition, wrote to the photographer Mike Segrist and explained that she thought the whole idea was foolish. According to Culp's printed statements, she indicated that Thomas Bay was no longer a primitive area, and it did not need exploring."
Virginia Culp passed away on February 18, 2010, at the age of 82. While many people mistakenly believed that Harry Culp was born in the United States, Virginia Culp knew the truth. Before her death, she led a family expedition to Nova Scotia to see where her father was born. There's one piece of the story I can't understand. According to the Culp family, the discovery of Harry's story came as a complete surprise. His wife and kids didn't know he'd created this imaginative piece of literature. He kept it hidden to himself, and it was only discovered after his death. Why did he keep it hidden? Why didn't he share it with the world? How many people have created their own masterpieces and hidden them away, never to be seen? Well, kids, what did you think? Did you like the story? Kids? Oh, you're asleep. Well, I guess the story worked. Good night. Wrangell History Unlocked is written and produced by Ronan Rooney. Learn more and read a transcript of today's episode at wranglehistoryunlocked.com/strangest story. Music and sound effects by epidemicsound.com. Thanks to John Schenk for agreeing to go on the record about Kushtika. And thanks to my family, Mary, Rosemary, and Conan, for appearing in today's episode. Thank you, Sandra Johnston, and the Alaska State Library for access to the original manuscript of The Strangest Story Ever Told. Today's episode makes fair use of portions of The Strangest Story Ever Told and is unaffiliated with the book or its publishers.
Thanks for tuning in to that special episode of The Strangest Story Ever Told from a Wrangell historian called Wrangell History Unlocked. It's a podcast you can find on Spotify or wherever you get your other podcasts. And it began in 2020 as an investigation to the history of Wrangell, Alaska, and also coincidentally Petersburg. Again, thanks for tuning in. Have a spooky week ahead.